Good evening. Welcome to From the Frontline. This is Peter Hammond in the Frontline studio. And today, 16 June, we are considering Soweto, the Soweto Uprising of 16 June 1976, the untold story. What you won't read in most of the mainstream, lamestream media or see in the Apartheid Museum or the state school textbooks, the book that's inspiring today's unique presentation is Soweto But God by Reverend Clark Gittens. It was published by Dorothea Mission. Now, Reverend Clark Gittens has done us an amazing service by putting together this 178-page book, Soweto But God. It was published in 1978. I was converted in 1977, and I remember one of the first books I put on the book table at Pines Baptist Church, the congregation to which I was converted, was this book, Soweto But God. I'd gotten it from the Protestant book room and where I got my book tables from. And immediately I came under severe criticism from some of the deacons of the church, wondering, what am I doing putting this obviously subversive communist book on the shelves? But I was a new convert. I trusted Protestant book room, and quite rightly so, under Reverend Jeffrey James, was a fine book room, and they had good Protestant materials. And this Soweto But God did have a kind of revolutionary-looking cover. You can actually see the book. We've just published it again. We've made available as a free ebook or PDF on the frontlinemissionsa.org website. And we've got an article on Soweto, 16 June 1976, The Untold Story, on the Gospel Defense League website. So this is very interesting. And if you want a snapshot of history 40 years ago, but it goes back further than that, actually, it really takes a very interesting long look, because the Dorothea Mission was embedded in the whole Soweto area. And good friends of mine were involved in the Dorothea Mission. For example, Tom Barlow, who was one of the heirs to the Barlow fortune. His father's company, Barlow Rand, is one of the Fortune 500 companies, very well run. He threw all that up and he became a faith missionary working for the Dorothea Mission. He actually married the daughter of Hans von Staden, the founder of Dorothea Mission. And another good friend of mine, Patrick Johnson, who founded the Operation World Ministry. He did that while with the Dorothea Mission, actually. The Dorothea Mission printed the first Operation World. And we're talking about right back in 1976, if I'm not mistaken. Dorothea Mission had weeks of prayer, and they asked Patrick Johnson to put together a guide to praying for the countries of the world. If I remember right, it was something like 28 countries he focused on, the first Op World, and was printed on an Aeronia machine in Soweto. So Operation World, which has become a phenomenon as the greatest intercessory handbook to world missions, produced by Patrick Johnson for 7 editions, and now Jason Mandrake has taken over the mantle of Patrick Johnson. And interesting that that started in Soweto under the Dorothea Mission. They were the first ones to sponsor, ask for, and print it. Well, from my friends, Tom Barlow, Patrick Johnson, I learned quite a lot about the Dorothea Mission. And when their book came out, Soweto But God, it created quite a sensation, because Soweto had hit the news. It was the great uprising. And of course, we all know the story, because in fact, it's become part of the myth and legend of the new South Africa. And today, 16 June, is a public holiday in South Africa. What are they actually celebrating? Well, the Soweto But God book gives us the raw facts. Now, this is not from some outside journalist. This is from missionaries embedded in the Soweto community, ministering to the people. And this is a very well-illustrated book. It's quite extraordinary. It was out of print. Some years ago, we sought permission from the Dorothea Mission to be able to reprint this book. And they gave us permission. And we worked on it. And we were having trouble getting some of the actual photographs and originals to improve the quality. And there was a few delays. Well, anyway, at this point, coming as we are up to the 16th of June, and doubtless people are going to be bombarded with propaganda, myth, and legend. Therefore, we thought, well, let's go back and just get a Christian insight to what happened on the 16th of June, 1976. I was not even a Christian when that happened, 1976. I was in Rhodesia at that time during the war there. But the next year, in April 1977, I was converted to Christ and then came across this book after it was published later on in 78. So this is interesting. So let me just read some extracts from the book to start with. The soldiers are coming. They're shooting. The 39-year-old mother could hear confusion in the street outside the school near home. She rushed out to see what was happening. It was awful. Parents were running to the school to fetch their children. Others were rushing out of the building, dragging the children with them. Noise and shouting filled the air. Fear was written on many faces. Then her attention was drawn to a neighbor's house. She saw her neighbor's three daughters were breaking the windows of their own home. "What are you doing?" she called to them. "We want to kill our mother," came the reply. "But why? She's your mother," cried this horrified woman, who herself is the mother of several children. These three girls were possessed by a spirit which overcame so many of the young people of Soweto on that dark day, the 16th of June 1976. Just then an aunt came on the scene and tried to stop the girl. She ran out to help her, and as they approached the house, one of the girls whipped out a knife and threatened these two women, aunts and friends, neighbors. "This is none of your business. Get away," they shouted. The two older women were helpless and in real danger of these hostile and violent girls with knives in hands, and they retreated. Well, then this woman invited the aunt into her house, and a little while later they went out, feeling they had to pray for the girls. This was too much for them. Suddenly she felt a sharp pain in her leg. One of these girls had thrown a brick at her while she stood praying. And their strange anger now centered on her. They cursed her and threatened to burn her house down. Now, these are black Christians in Soweto that are reporting on this. For a moment, she was terrified and wanted to run, but then she realized that she'd only make things worse if she ran. They would pursue her. They would kill her. She ran calm and slowly walked back into her house where two of her own frightened children met her. "Do not be afraid," she said calmly. "Come, let us pray." This took place on that Thursday morning, 16 June. The same evening, there's a prayer meeting for the young people in her home. She told the children about those three girls and asked them to pray for them. The next morning, their mother came to thank her for what she had done the previous day. She was, however, still frightened about what had happened, and they saw her deep need and began to tell about the Lord Jesus. It was a wonderful moment when the two women prayed together and the neighbor, in her need, opened her heart to the Savior. This formerly frightened mother was now filled with the abundant joy of Christ. The riots had actually led to her redemption. Satan had overreached himself. Once again, Satan was overcome by the one who had conquered him on the cross of Calvary. And so on a Saturday evening, one of the daughters came back to the mother and wanted to ask for her forgiveness. There's just one incredible story amidst the violence of the 16th of June 1976, which is in the book Soweto But God, published in 1978 by the Dorothea Mission. And written by Reverend Clark Gittins, it draws on research, interviews with the Sowetans, and first-hand accounts from the missionaries and evangelists of Dorothea Mission, such as from the founder, Hans van Staden, who knew and loved and worked alongside the people of Soweto. He knew that the people in Soweto needed the gospel, and as was well said in the quote at the back of the book, Lenin said, Vladimir Lenin said, "The road to Africa lies through Africa. The road to Europe lies through Africa. Well, the road to Africa lies through Soweto." That was the comment of Dr. Leister, director of the Africa Institute. Well, Soweto may have been a match that set ablaze the downward turn of South Africa towards a Marxist-led country. But as the author demonstrates, what man meant for evil, God still used for good, and God is still at work to turn tragic events for his people's good and for God's glory, for the kingdom of God. We are involved in a spiritual world war. There are terrible conflicts on the go right now. And this is a time of madness and a time of revolution. But for people to understand what was going on in Soweto at that time, it comes out, you start to see the spiritual war, the battle for people's hearts and minds, and to understand that during the Soweto riots, it was actually what the Marxists call the uprising. They don't call them the riots, they call them the Soweto uprising or youth uprising. And it becomes clear as you read this incredible, fascinating book, which is very well illustrated. There's pictures on virtually every second page. And it gives you an insight into a time 4.5, 5 decades ago. You get to see what life was like in Soweto before this happened. And what happened on the 16th of June was well organized. It was well orchestrated. In fact, plainly, the Soviet Union actually announced in their press reports at the time that this uprising in Soweto, 16 June 1976, was the result of their African National Congress and the Southern Communist Party. This was the result of the Communist International, the Comintern's goals, and they claimed it as a great propaganda victory. And so that's not something that the South African government propaganda at the time said. That's what the Soviets were saying. This is our uprising. We organized it. We orchestrated it. The African National Congress, which we have been training in Tanzania and Zambia, they have succeeded in bringing about this uprising. Well, according to the missionaries and the Christians in Soweto, this was a time of anti-Christian persecution. While most of the news headlines and attention went to the clashes between rioters and police, the focus of this book is overwhelmingly on the persecution of Christians, the burning of churches, the attacking of the homes of Christians, the murdering of missionaries and pastors. Plainly, this was an anti-Christian riot, and many of them saw it as this was a time of madness, a time when there was demon possession taking hold of young people and tearing apart the communities where people even were attacking their own parents. And so to understand this, there's the quote from Brother Andrew. Brother Andrew, in his book Battle for Africa, explains, "The South African church is one of tremendous devotion to Christ. It has the spiritual muscle and the financial resources to reach Africa. I believe Satan is aware that South Africa has this potential, and consequently, Satan works hard to isolate South Africa from the rest of the world. South Africa has been singled out for boycott, embarrassment, and criticism, particularly, I believe, because Satan wants to isolate South Africa to prevent it from fulfilling its divine commission." That's a quote from Brother Andrew, God Smuggler, in Battle for Africa. To understand the revolutionary campaigns of the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, which was galvanized to force South Africa to surrender to godless communism, we need to remember the insights of the 19th century German military strategist Clausewitz. War is an act of violence to break the enemy's will. It is not the loss of men, horses, or guns, but of order, courage, confidence, cohesion, and plan. It's principally moral forces which decide here. Now, for decades, South Africa was the target of an unprecedented international media propaganda campaign, economic warfare, disinvestment, sanctions, and revolutionary violence, riots, landmines, limpet mines, car bombs, petrol bombs, grenade attacks through windows at night. 2 Peter 2 verse 19 says, "While they promised them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption." 2 Peter 2:19. So, in an article published by the South African Communist Party, The Way Forward from Soweto, they summarized the agenda behind the riots. "There is no doubt that, taken as a whole, the Soweto events have opened a new chapter in the history of the revolutionary struggle." And the riots, the uprising in Soweto, profoundly changed the socio-political landscape in South Africa. The director of the Dorothea Mission, Hans van Staden, wrote in the foreword to the book that the Soweto riots might mean the beginning of the end for Christian civilization in South Africa. The Soweto uprising, as it's called by the politically correct, is often called the turning point in the anti-apartheid movement. The liberal media certainly used the at first shocking sight of pictures of children shot by the police to manipulate the overseas world media to further condemn South Africa and to strengthen sanctions against her people. Well, this book, this missionary book, Soweto But God, gives a glimpse into the violence caused not by soldiers or police, but by the rioters themselves. Indeed, the burning of the vehicles and the buildings, and the opportunistic looting of homes and businesses, and the murder of government officials and of missionaries, is rarely mentioned in average narrative of the riots or the uprising. In fact, if it's mentioned at all, it's praised by those who are sympathetic to the Marxist instigators. And this is particularly relevant today when we see so much of America torn apart by similar kinds of riots, which are being portrayed in an almost legendary, mythical way of being something wonderful and good in much of the mainstream, lamestream media. But they are being very selective and they are ignoring often the extremely devastating, destructive and violent aspects of it. So here in this book, we get a different view. And these are just quotes from Soweto But God. I'm reading straight from the book. The book is right here. But you can read it if you go onto our Gospel Defense League website, or you can read the entire book and an article that's based on it. And the book's got all the pictures. It's a lot of pictures in there. So, on the morning of June the 16th, 1976, 10,000, some claim 20,000, black high school pupils staged a protest march. Chanting Black Power slogans, waving crude and inflammatory placards, they walked through the streets of Soweto. The demonstration was supposed to be a peaceful one. Unfortunately, it didn't stay that way. The police moved in, tried to disperse the marchers, stones were thrown, shots were fired. The peaceful protest march exploded into an orgy of fighting, burning, looting, and killing. The violence went on for 4 days, and when the order was finally restored, 176 people were dead, over 1,000 were injured, mostly at the hands of the rioters themselves. It was a tremendous boost to the creation of Soweto when Sir Ernst Oppenheimer arranged for a loan of 6 million rand for township development in 1956. It was meant at last to be a realistic approach to planning, marking out and building a city, and it meant the new township could be surveyed and pegged out, and water and sanitation, other essential services were planned and construction begun. And since then, the building of Soweto waxed and waned according to the amount of money on hand. But in the heyday of building, it was claimed that no fewer than 63 houses were being built every day. At the time of writing, 1978, there were 9,500 people on waiting lists for houses. And as always, lack of money held up the program. But a new and imaginative revolving fund was created, and they hoped to have 2 million rand by the beginning of 78. Well, by early 1976, about 13,000 people lived in their own homes. Houses that actually would be a credit in any city in any country. Most of these houses were of the old style, and they added kitchens, bathrooms, toilets, extra bathrooms, carports, garages. And you'd be quite amazed to have seen, and we'll see in the pictures, of the kind of furnishings and quality of many of these houses and the standard of living of these well laid out, very well spaced with lots of various facilities, the vast amount of schools and hospitals and clinics and sports fields and all kinds of thoughtful things from libraries on to soccer stadiums and others. Soweto was actually pretty well laid out and planned, even though more and more people poured in, make it harder and harder to keep up with the standard that was set up at the beginning. But some of the houses in Dube would not have been out of place in the best suburbs of Johannesburg or Pretoria, they said. The shadowy, dangerous streets, which had always been a haunt for criminals at night, were transformed by the erection of high-powered, high-mast lights at every intersection. And by the end of the 1960s, most of Soweto's houses had electricity. But the phenomenal population increase of people pouring in, migrant labourers from across the borders, always outstripped the provision of housing. Newcomers arrived, babies were born quicker than houses could be built up. Most of the money that was needed to build the houses and to provide the facilities and services for Soweto came from white taxpayers in neighbouring Johannesburg. The Johannesburg City Council was responsible for the township and subsidised the building programme, the running costs from their own income from their ratepayers. But every effort was made to enable Soweto to pay for at least some of their own expenses, but rentals for houses and fees for the services were very low, but they brought in some revenue. Another scheme which brought in a great deal of money was sale of sorghum beer to the residents. There were some protests to this, it actually was the West Rand Administrative Board offices that were prime targets during the riots, and not one was left standing. They were all burned to the ground during the uprising. After the riots, 13 of the 41-member Soweto Urban Council resigned. But the remaining 28 members still met regularly with officials of WRAB and their people, and there were consultations between the citizens in Meadowlands, Deep Kloof, Dobsonville, all parts of Soweto. And the chairman of the West Rand Administrative Board, Minister Mulder, made a practice of arranging direct discussions with cabinet ministers to deal with all their issues, and they overcame a lot of tensions and misunderstandings. And then the next stage was they started to work for the development of a community council. And this was actually undermined by the riots because many people who were happy to stand as candidates or vote for candidates were intimidated by the African National Congress, intimidated groups that basically they didn't want a city council representing the people. They wanted it to look like they were unrepresented. And so, as in Rhodesia during the war, there was a targeting of town councillors and there was a targeting of people voting for the town councillors. So that was undermined. So the director of the African Institute said, it would be foolish and naive for South Africans to imagine that the riots in Soweto were no more than the work of communist agitators and go back to sleep with a complacent thought that the police will deal with the matter. But he said, on the other hand, it would be downright stupidity to deny communist influences. It was abundantly clear from the pattern of events on the day of the riots, and even more so from what took place since then, that well-trained troublemakers, agitators, were definitely involved in the disturbances and riots in Soweto and other parts of the country. Various newspaper reports at the time recorded that after the disturbance was well underway in Soweto, cars with Johannesburg registration numbers were seen in other townships along the reef. And wherever these appeared, trouble flared up. The people at Natalspruit near Germiston ran to the police station with the words, God help us, the agitators from Soweto have come here. If this was not enough, we've got a statement from Mr. Tabiev, a member of the Presidium of the Supreme Council of the Soviet Union, when he visited Dar es Salaam October 1976. Speaking at this public meeting, this Soviet Supreme Council Politburo member declared, the recent events in South Africa were not a spontaneous happening. They were the result of the work organized National Liberation Movement officials of the African National Congress, the ANC, operating on a broad front, embracing workers, students, and people from rural areas, including many whites, coloreds, and Indians. So that's quoting from a Soviet Union Politburo member in Dar es Salaam, just October that year, 1976, after the riots. So we need to realize just how important South Africa was and is from a political, military, and economic point of view, and even more from a spiritual point of view. Politically and militarily, South Africa is still one of the most strategic, important countries in the world today. Lenin declared, Vladimir Lenin, that Southern Africa will be one of the main obstacles to the communist program of world conquest. And military strategists of all shades of opinion repeatedly underlined the important fact that they had to control the Cape Sea route to be in control of much of the Indian Ocean and the South Atlantic, and any hostile power who could have a stranglehold on Southern Africa could have a stranglehold on Britain, Europe, and America. Economically, South Africa occupies an important position in world commerce. Gold, platinum, uranium, vanadium, cobalt, so many important minerals which are essential for everything from refrigerators, satellites, fighter bombers, jets, aircraft carriers. The strategic mineral control dominance of South Africa in these areas cannot be overstated. So South Africa was strategic in terms of minerals, in terms of maritime shipping, in terms of the military, having the greatest military in all of Africa, superpower of Africa, so to speak. One book declared the superpower of Africa. And South Africa also, of course, the greatest missionary-sending country of Africa. So its importance was very strategic. And all the attempts in recent years to isolate the Republic of South Africa from the rest of the world only served to underline the fact of its importance and strategic position. And that's why, with more and more countries pressured to cut trade with South Africa or disinvest or have sanctions, even supporting revolutionaries based on their borders in order to come into South Africa and lay landmines, limpet mines, car bombs, and so on. It just showed South Africa was an attractive prize in the eyes of the power mad and the unscrupulous. But more important than all this is the spiritual significance of the country. South Africa back in the 1970s was a God-fearing country. Bibles were distributed to soldiers in the army before they even received their rifles. In the military, chaplains' periods every day was compulsory. Church services on Sunday were compulsory. Blasphemy was illegal throughout the whole country. Schools in South Africa began with Bible reading, hymn singing, and prayer, and there was Bible education classes in the schools. Pornography was illegal. Films were censored of everything pornographic, blasphemous, and of vile nature. And the whole country was brought to a standstill every Sunday. Every shop was shut. Cinemas were shut. The only thing open on Sundays was effectively the church. So it was a Sabbath-observing country with strict laws against pornography, perversion, abortion, blasphemy. These things were completely illegal. And the Bible societies were tax-exempt, and Bibles were tax-exempt. And the army used the voluntary tithes of the soldiers to subsidize the Bible society and Bible translations into African languages. So there's a lot of things going on in South Africa at the time that were not fitting into the public narrative, and people didn't really understand what was going on in South Africa. But at the time, films, television, radio, books, magazines, newspapers all started to be used to break down the moral standards, to promote dissatisfaction, to promote unrest, to push the envelope, to try and see what could be eked in there. While pornography was illegal, they'd sort of try and push the envelope and scope with girly magazines and regularly getting banned when they just pushed too far. And there was so much attempt by professors and universities, by editors and newspapers, to try and undermine the moral standards of the country and try and belittle the Christian standards that were being elevated there. And we have sworn testimony of many ex-communists that they were given expert training in the arts of incitement, fanning grievances, real or imagined or exaggerated, into confrontation and conflict with the authorities, with the goal being to promote confusion and anarchy. And so the goals were corrupt and conquer, confuse, divide and conquer. And often these agitators would be pushing and trying to get impressionable youth to be out in the front, using them as expendable cannon fodder for the revolution, wanting some of them to become casualties, encouraging them to go and throw rocks and Molotov cocktails at police, hoping that some of them would get shot so that they could then focus on that as an example of police brutality. So provoke, and then focus media on the reaction. So when the truth has been told, there were a lot of things going on in the schools. There was a lot of actual incitement, and a rebellious generation was being raised up. And a prominent black Christian tried to explain the reasons to the author in this way, saying, black parents up till now have always been very close to the children. But now the family unit was undermined as they were being told not to respect their parents, and they were being encouraged to undermine their parents and to regard their parents as compromisers and Uncle Toms and sellouts. And so, in fact, they were getting to the point where the children were being encouraged to think of revolution, rebellion, and even killing their own parents. And the citizens of South Africa at the time considered themselves to be generally Bible-believing Christians, and most, unfortunately, did not recognize the demonic spiritual forces at work in their country and even pressurizing and seeking to hijack their own children. And so the no education before liberation slogan, which led to the burning down of thousands of black schools throughout the country, and the destruction of civic centers and libraries and sports facilities and gyms and other things that were built for the people, stealing from the very communities that they were claiming to want to lift up, but in fact increasing their suffering. So today, much of the damage done to South Africa during this time is blamed on apartheid, whereas it would be more accurate to blame it directly laid at the feet of the communist movements, the Southern Communist Party, the African National Congress, and others, UDF, United Democratic Front, and others who grew up to take the place of those groups that were officially banned. But they said the Sowetans we're aware of the terrible things taking place in communist Mozambique and Angola after the communist revolution. And yet they said, but they were the minority. They said many of our neighbors were deceived by false and misleading propaganda and were believing the communist slogans of "you have nothing to lose but your chains, workers of the world unite, throw in your lot and join the freedom fighters," so-called, even though freedom never followed. And so the sophisticated people of Soweto and those well-informed were well aware of how communism was destroying the lives of their neighbors in Mozambique and Angola, and the terrorism that was being perpetrated against elders and pastors and missionaries in Rhodesia, what later became Zimbabwe. But there was a lot of the younger people who bought into the propaganda and the lies. And so a Rand Daily Mail article, 1976, is quoted from in the book. "Parents of school-going children in Soweto or in other black townships in Transvaal are facing a heartbreaking dilemma. Their children are turning against them. The children are blaming the elders for collaborating with the apartheid system. The message shone through this week when I interviewed a number of black parents and teenage high school pupils. The middle-aged black journalist with an 18-year-old son at high school said, 'It is breaking my heart to see my son changing overnight. He no longer confides in me. He jeers at me, and he jeers at his mother for working so hard so we can send him and his elder brother and sister to school.'" Well, it's too easy and simplistic to see the problems of Soweto merely in terms of confrontation between black and white. It's far more accurate to see it as black and white against red. The newspapers in South Africa and around the world have done their best to make people believe that this is a simple black-white racial conflict. But the picture of blacks and whites at each other's throat does not stand up to the harsh light of reality. And you can see many of the pictures in Soweto But God that shows many black people risked their lives to protect whites during the rioting. Many of the black citizens of Soweto took food and coffee to the white policemen standing guard in their townships during the nights of troubles. This doesn't fit the media narrative, so it's normally left out. It doesn't account for the services with black and white worshipping together and the work of the Dorothea Mission and the door-to-door evangelism and the Bible studies and prayer meetings taking place in many of these houses. But they were the ones targeted in many cases. There were prominent churchmen who know black Sowetans have stated bluntly that they took the opportunity of the uprising to settle old grudges and feuds amongst themselves, sometimes tribal, sometimes problems between clans and gangs. But there was a criminal element which came in and took over with the Soweto riots, probably knowing they were coming, and used them for looting, used it for murder, used it for destruction, particularly of Christian families, homes, businesses, and churches. And so one needs to realize the Soweto riots of 1976, the 16 June events, it doesn't fit the myth that's been built up, the legend of peaceful youth protesting being crushed by horrible police. But it was a satanic, Soviet-inspired, Marxist revolution that destroyed a lot of lives and property and was designed to promote revolution. And, of course, was a huge amount of roving Tsotsis, won't-work types, taking the disturbances as a golden opportunity to loot, kill, and enjoy themselves and enrich themselves, while their previously sedate and studious cousins were embroiled with the police. And so it's interesting to see, for example, some statistics in Soweto But God that, for example, in 1972, 54,000 black Africans in South Africa and Soweto spent the holidays outside of South Africa. There was more than 3,300 business trips beyond the borders by black businessmen inside the country. The standard of living of blacks in Soweto and, in fact, throughout South Africa as a whole was higher than that in any other country in Africa at that time, including Mozambique, Angola, all the way up to Nigeria. And the trouble is that too many white South Africans were willing to stand by complacency while a hard materialistic society thoroughly indoctrinates the people into believing that material, social, political things are all that matters in life. And many people's lifestyle reinforced that. And the awful truth is that before the Soweto uprising, there was a famine on sound biblical teaching and evangelical preaching in the midst of this apparent wealth of religion. There was a lot of churches, a lot of religion in Soweto, but a lot of it was religion. And there wasn't enough Bible-believing born again, you must be born again, regenerate preaching, dealing with transformed lives, preaching against sin, doing real discipleship. And so as a result, there was many churches that gotten politicized, many churches that were more secular than spiritual. And the book, Soweto But God, is a hard, realistic look at the positives, the negatives, the evil, the good, the godly, the satanic. It's all there. Fight and contend for the faith once delivered into the saints. We've got a problem of desperate spiritual needs in the townships. And you can see the love of the people of Dorothea Mission, in particular for the people of Soweto, how they were deeply embedded in the communities, how they really cared for the people, how they were seeking to do everything they could to win them to Christ. So we today are facing a new generation of riots, and doubtless there are people who'd like to glamorize and simplify and mythologize the riots of today into some kind of popular uprising, ignoring the real hard core of Antifa revolutionaries who have a very malicious agenda. And so we need to understand the psychological warfare we're involved in. We need to understand that Christian civilization has been targeted. And the methods used are guilt manipulation, gaslighting. Some people have the Stockholm syndrome where they actually are identifying with their hijackers and abusers, like you can imagine a battered wife who makes excuses for her husband and is a co-enabler. No, I walked into the pole, I fell down the stairs, you know, trying to explain away the bruises and the abuse, and even sometimes attacking the police who come to try and protect the wife from the battered husband who her neighbors reported. And so you get people who are being abused, having the Stockholm syndrome and trying to defend the very people who are trying to abuse them. We need to understand the role of the Gramsci termite strategy. This is part of the Frankfurt School of Communism. Many people don't understand this, but I would encourage you to go onto the frontlinemissionsa.org website and Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism and look on these websites at some of the videos, audios, articles on how Marxists subvert churches and society, and learn about the confuse, divide and conquer, corrupt and conquer strategy, and understand that the issues are seldom the issue. In fact, the issue is never the issue. The issue is the revolution. And they will use black against white, male against female, straight against gay. They will use workers against employers. It's class warfare here. It's gender warfare there. But the issue is never the issue, because the revolution is only after power. And once they get that power, then they are planning the second phase of the revolution. First political control, then it's economic and it's cultural and every kind of area of society control, just as one saw in the Soviet Union, Red China, even going back to the French Revolution, is always a second phase of the revolution. And then there are those like Trotsky who wanted perpetual revolution. So we need to know how Marxists subvert church and society. We need to know the heart and soul of Karl Marx. We've got an article on that. We've got PowerPoint on it. We've got presentation, The Heart and Soul of Karl Marx. You can see that on the frontlinemissionsa.org website. There's an article and a presentation, a video that I've done on Do Not Be Deceived. There's so much in the Bible warning us to not be deceived. There's excellent books written, for example, by Dr. David Noble, Understanding the Times. That comes from the verse in Chronicles about the people who understood the times and knew what God's people should do. And we need to understand our times. And I'm afraid most people do not understand the times. We are, in all too many cases, brainwashed, indoctrinated, guilt manipulated, and therefore paralyzed with pessimism, unable to respond to the revolutionary agenda. I would encourage all listeners who can to go on the web and look for Agenda, Grinding America Down, and Agenda 2, Masters of Deceit. These are excellent videos by Curtis Bowers. Agenda gives you the agenda of the Marxists and how they've worked to take over every area of life, especially entertainment industry, news media, education institutions. Marxists teach five culture-carrying, culture-transforming institutions that they aim to subvert and infiltrate. In most cases, they've been very successful. Number one, the thumb is education. Number two, entertainment, Hollywood. Number three, news media. Number four, religious institutions. Number five, political institutions. Now, these are the five areas that they aim to infiltrate and subvert, and generally have completely hijacked. We, on the other hand, we need to get in there and redeem those areas. Now, Professor Martin Luther warned us 500 years ago, Martin Luther warned us, I'm much afraid that schools will prove to be wide gates to hell unless they diligently labor in explaining the Holy Scriptures, engraving them on the hearts of the youth. I advise no one to place his child where the Scriptures do not reign paramount. Every institution in which men are not constantly occupied with the Word of God must become corrupt. Do you see what Professor Luther is warning about? That if schools are not Bible-based, if they're not Christ-centered, if they're not daily applying the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life, engraving the Scriptures on the hearts of youth, then those institutions must become corrupt. And when people look in horror, aghast, at the toppling of monuments, burning of museums, destruction of so much, shops, looting, causing vast amounts of damage in the streets and gutting many inner cities, making it look like war zones. And some pictures, I've seen pictures of Minneapolis, which looked like it could have been Syria in the middle of a war. And of course, this is a war. But the trouble is, in many cases, the people on the streets throwing the rocks and the Molotov cocktails, the arsonists and anarchists, in many cases, are children from Christian homes. In many cases, they are people who've gone through our church youth programs. And it's been documented by Ken Ham of Answers in Genesis in his book Already Gone, that over two-thirds of children from Christian homes and Christian churches end up leaving the church within a few years of leaving school. And why is it that so many of the young people are easy pickings for the Marxists and for the atheists? It's because in all too many cases, they don't have a biblical worldview. They didn't understand the times. They didn't understand how Marxism works. They didn't understand cultural Marxism's critical race theory or any of these vastly important things, the Frankfurt School, the Gramsci-Turmut strategy, the role of Herbert Marcuse, teaching the importance of using foul language, blasphemy and obscenity in the arts and in entertainment to as a war against Western Christian civilization, and the goal of people like Antonio Gramsci to use pornography to infiltrate and undermine Christian civilization in the West. They don't understand what we're involved in. A war for the family, a war against children, a war against fathers, a battle for our history, a battle for the culture. History matters. That's why they're attacking monuments. Just try and destroy the culture. Read George Orwell's 1984 to understand the role of the Marxists to obliterate people's history, to cut people off from their roots as the biggest and quickest, easiest way to destroy people. So this is why we need biblical worldview summits. Truth matters. History matters. I encourage you, visit our www.reformationsa.org website for historical articles, for we've for 15 years been running seminars and meetings and every Thursday night meetings on looking at examples of excellence in the victorious Christians who changed the world, which is now a book, and Greatest Century of Reformation, which is now a book, Greatest Century of Missions, which is also now a book, and How to Reform Our Families, which is also now a book, and Power of Prayer Handbook. These are all focuses. We've got audios, we've got videos, PowerPoints, and many of these presentations and books over the last 15 years of the Reformation Society. You can find some great Bible studies and sermons and Bible surveys on every book of the Bible in livingstonfellowship.co.za website. Quite a few also in video format too, and well illustrated ones. We'd encourage you, make use of these resources. And if you can at all attend a Biblical Worldview Summit, then aim to, in Cape Town, the first week of January each year, we run a Biblical Worldview Summit, which is a crash course on understanding worldviews and knowing how to answer the skeptics and how to apply the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life. Absolutely essential for people today to be able to survive the revolution and to know how to defend yourself, to know how to defend your faith, to know what you believe, why you believe it, and how to defend an argument. Home education, absolutely vital. Visit christianlibertybooks.co.za for great resources for home education. One of the most practical things we can do, disengage from the world's brainwashing mass media, disengage from Hollywood's vile, degrading, debasing, degenerate form of so-called entertainment, support alternative Christian entertainment, alternative Christian news sources, contemporary materials, local community Christian radio stations, and homeschool. If we can save our young people, if we can disengage from the indoctrination gulags of the world, we can build a generation, a Joshua generation, that'll go in and take the land and not back down. We need to stand for our faith. We need to step out in faith. We need to fight the good fight of faith. Let's not be those who are just victims. Let's become victors. So we encourage you, go onto our website and our social media, frontlinemissionsa.org. Listen to some of the previous presentations of From the Frontline. If this is the first one you've come to, look in our archives and you'll see we tackle a lot of these issues in greater depth. If some of what's been said seems a bit surprising or mystical to you, then go back and hear more about how Marxists subvert churches and society, understand how the Black Lives Matter is really a new religious cult, and the racism riots and the role of the media and revolution. These are all issues that have been dealt with in previous times. So we encourage you, do your research, contact us. Our email is mission@frontline.org.za, mission@frontline.org.za, that's the email. And you can visit our website, www.frontlinemissionsa.org. May God bless you. Contend for the faith once delivered to the saints. Until next time, good night.